spite of the fact that I've known you for many years, Dr. Miller, I can't recall how you first became interested in the field of music. What circumstances led you to choose your career?
I might say that it was fortunate that I had an aunt living in our home who sang quite well, and also my sister was a very fine pianist, and it just seemed natural that I began to become interested in music generally, and I decided that that's what I wanted to do, even as young as I was at that time. So my interest and training really began when I was quite young at home.
How young? Can you remember when you first felt the urge to go into the field of music?
Well, piano lessons started when I was about 8 years old, and this aunt of mine gave me voice training, you might say, holding me on her knee and teaching me the notes to sing the alto parts to her soprano.
Well, did you have any contact with any other instruments, did you, other than piano and voice?
Violin. It so happened that some country fiddlers lived nearby, and in the summer days they would get out on the porch and play all evening, and there were three or four boys in this family, and they were all fiddlers, as they called themselves. Mm-hmm. And of course this thrilled me a great deal, and I spent a great deal of time sitting with my mouth wide open listening to them, and it seems that I soon acquired a violin, or fiddle as they called it. And I began playing whatever I heard them play without notes, by ear. So that started quite early.
Uh-huh. If I'm not mistaken, I occasionally now hear you in your studio while you're teaching using the violin. Have you found that a valuable tool?
It has been most valuable to me. And especially in teaching a student the melodies. The violin being a melody instrument, or you might say a solo instrument, I find it very useful. It so happens that one of my early voice teachers used the violin a great deal in his teaching. So I have continued this right along. Of course, I don't have time to practice and keep up my technique, but it's there and I use it when my accompanist is not present.
Mm-hmm. Well, then, as you grew up and went through high school, what did you do then? How did you receive your training, and where did you study, and who were your teachers?
Well, soon after leaving high school, I began my studies going to and from Knoxville. We were living only 20 miles from Knoxville, and of course this gave me a good opportunity to find real good teachers. And it was there that, this really started before I left high school. Yes, of course it did. It was there that both the violin and voice training actually began in earnest. And this once-a-week trip was made for both the violin and voice to Knoxville. And that's where it began. And there, of course, from this I went on to college, which happened to be Carson Newman. It wasn't too far away. And I studied, entered college as a major in voice, and violin was secondary or minor. And of course, I stayed there and finished my work, having very fine teachers. Miss Joy Bond, my principal voice teacher, was a protege of William Shakespeare, the great teacher in London, England. And I was very, very fortunate there. And my violin teachers were Bill Roberts and Dr. E. O. Casserman. And I felt that I was quite fortunate in this. And it was later, after going through Carson Newman College, that I was urged, and I liked it, to go on to New York City, which I did in a very short time, and studied with some very eminent teachers.
And when you were there, how in the world did you finance this? How were you able to just go to New York to study? Did you hold a position of some kind while you were in New York?
Well, I was fortunate, and I had to have the means of paying for my lessons. And it so happens that it was soon in a nice church job. I'd had sufficient training to get a paid church job, a soloist. And also fortunate in picking up business positions that enabled me to continue my lessons.
And who did you study with there?
Well, I was first with Madame Burns Ruhr, supposed to be a very fine teacher and a fine singer. Later with John W. Nichols, who was a concert artist and teacher, Sergei Klebanski, very fine.
Yes, and I've heard all those names are very familiar.
Frederick Haywood, who is possibly now known as the most eminent of all. Then my coaching was done with Emil J. Pollock, William Reddick, and Faye Foster. Faye Foster, you know, was noted for her writing of The Americans Come, World War II. Became a very popular war song. And I also coached with William Reddick, and let's see, I've almost forgotten the other, can't think the name just at this moment.
Some time ago.
That matters
well,
too much.
No, it'll occur to you. Now, how long were you in New York in this particular study period? And this took place after your college work, so.
Yes, immediately.
How long were you there?
Several years, I'd say about seven in all.
Mm-hmm.
Then I was doing quite a lot of public singing, a concert here and there. And I actually thought that I was going to desired the place of a concert singer. But I found that was beyond me because of managerial financial troubles, that actually they wanted as much as $25,000 to promote me for 2 years with no guarantee of any success,
wow.
You know. And I, of course, I didn't have the money, and I began thinking about teaching.
Mm-hmm.
And it so happened that this position opened up at University of Florida.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went to Florida and was there for 3 years. University and actually started the music department.
Mm-hmm. Well, don't you think, and I suppose this is true of all people who turn from trying to be, let's say, a nationally known artist, that to get into the field of singing and as a teacher and as a promoter in a community of choruses and good music, that your influence, the influence you've yielded and wielded, has been much greater because of the fact that you didn't just give concerts. I've always felt it is quite a pity often that great artists do not turn into good teachers for some reason, I don't know why, but in your case, and this is very close to my life, of course, it was so wonderful that you came to Chattanooga because this helped us in so many different ways. What other experiences did you have before you came here?
Well, after my work at the University of Florida, position opened at Shorter College as the head of the voice department and choral work. I stayed there only 2 or 3 years. Then a much better position opened at Greenville Woman's College and Furman University in Greenville, South Carolina. this position I held for a number of years. And it was there that I began to really do my best work with the Furman University Glee Club. It so happened at that time the Glee Clubs were very popular. And we had a national, international organization, and the United States was divided up into sections. We were in the southern, of course, including several, five or six states. And we had our annual contests in each section, and the winner of that section had a free trip to New York with 30 boys and a student director. All expenses paid. We went up against people like Princeton, Harvard, Yale, Ohio State, and some 15 or 16 of the best glee clubs in the United States, coming from other sections of the country.
Well, that was certainly a great honor. How did you feel that you ranked with these absolutely top-notch, endowed, heavily endowed colleges?
Well, we did our part, and in some instances very well, but we never made better than fifth.
I see.
Out of 15.
Well, I think
I might tell you. I might tell you one interesting thing that happened. My boys stood with their hands down at their sides, you know.
Yes.
And at that time, most glee clubs, the boys held their hands behind them.
Yes.
Well, we went on and stuck to our hands at our sides, and the following year, or the next trip we made, all but one club stood as we did the first year.
Quite a compliment.
So now you notice that most all groups of that sort stand with their hands hanging at their side. Mm-hmm. It's a more natural position.
Mm-hmm. Then, however, you wound up before coming here again in New York. Tell us a little about that.
Well, in ending my work at Greenville, I decided to go back to New York and do some further study, and also to possibly do some teaching. So I went back to my old teacher, Fred Haywood, in Steinway Hall, and started work with him. Got the position as head of voice department and choral work at the fashionable Catholic school at New Rochelle, 800 girls. And one interesting fact was there that I noticed during the winter was that every girl out of the 800 had a fur coat. So of course that meant that it was a school with plenty of money.
Yeah.
At least the students had money. And in addition to this, we had a choral group there that gave an annual concert in Town Hall in New York City, which we did, and usually the big dignitaries of the Catholic Church were present and occupied all the boxes and so on. So we had quite an evening of it once a year. I also, I feel fortunate that I was asked to conduct the West Side YMCA Glee Club, and also the Bellevue Hospital Nurses Glee Club. And these all were fairly well-paying positions, you know. So
yeah.
I was getting along very well.
Mm-hmm.
So I was also getting quite a number of engagements in and around New York City along with my, I had gotten some church jobs again. And was singing at that time, by the way, with the Fifth Avenue Presbyterian Church in Quartet.
Well, you certainly had a wide variety of experiences. Before you came here, even, you'd had about 15 years of voice study.
Oh, yes.
At least. And then you had these many positions that qualified you through the gainful experiences you had with them for the position you finally came to here. And we brought you here to be head of the voice department of the Chatty Conservatory in 1930. And ever since then, you've led a busy life helping our community develop culturally. However, if I remember rightly, you had an engagement here with a pianist, and I think you said that was probably your first contact with Chattanooga. Tell us something about that.
That was during my stay at Shorter College that Jan Kiyopuso, a concert pianist, came to America during the World War I. Now that's getting way back. I'm almost telling secrets here. But he was a very fine concert pianist, and we were doing some engagements here and there, jointly, voice and piano. So we came to Chattanooga and presented a concert in the Chattuck Hall, I suppose it was called then.
No, Chattuck Conservatory Hall. I don't think you had it. I think it was at the Unitarian Church, if you
Well, it was. That's right.
It was on Houston Street. That building no longer exists there. But yeah. I remember it so clearly. I can still see you and hear you and hear this pianist. It made a very deep impression on me. And you remember what happened?
What about the pedals falling off the grand piano? That was an experience I've never had before or since.
Well, I can't tell you. I looked from the audience, this great pianist working at the instrument, and all of a sudden he looked down under the piano in this despairing look and stopped playing. And then all you came out too and tried to help fasten it on.
Well, I even got under the piano.
Yes, it wasn't really, it hadn't been put on properly and just fell off while he was playing. I can remember that very clearly.
That was an interesting experience. And I do remember people were standing here and there and some sitting on the side of the windows.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it was very. Mm-hmm. And shortly before you came to join our staff, my father, Joseph Ochadik, died. And as a memorial to him, we founded the Chadik Choral Society in 1930. This eventually became the Civic Chorus. And I well remember writing the newspaper articles inviting the singers to join the new organization. Do you recall how they responded?
It was utterly astounding. The first meeting we had over 80 men and women. Mm. And the next week, we had 150, as I recall. And it was then that we decided, instead of making it a study group, we would organize an oratorio society. Mm-hmm. And it was then that we got busy and invited the public, and soon we had around 200 people singing once a week.
You know, that's one reason why it turned into the Civic Chorus. It became financially embarrassing to the conservatory to buy the music and to put on the performances at various places in the city. Where did you start out, and what sort of accompaniment did you have?
Well, fortunately, we had some very good accompanists on the faculty. So we used piano for our rehearsals. And as I recall, we used possibly only 3 or 4 instruments for our first concert, which was, by the way, presented in the smaller hall in the Memorial Auditorium. And we gave the secular group a number called The Rose Maiden by Cowan. And speaking of the music, you know, we requested that the members own their own copy of music. And they, without hesitation, paid for their own music and carried it back and forth, which was wonderful. And it was at that time we had no fees of any sort. A little later, I believe, we charged a monthly, very small monthly fee. But it was an interesting experience there, especially in those first few days or weeks of the organization.
Yes, I've never seen a more quick response in any organization of a musical character. And of course, I must compliment you on the fact, because as you remember, in spite of the fact that everybody hated to go up to the little theater, you had to climb, I think, 3 high flights of stairs.
Yes.
There were no escalators the way we now have in this building, which is a big improvement. But in those days, for so many people to respond and come to hear your performances, You finally had to go to a larger place, is that right?
Yes, we, of course, had the large hall in the same building, seating around 5,000. And shall I say here that we decided to do a large work immediately when we had this great chorus. And I believe we decided to do Samson and Delilah.
Mm-hmm. What artists did you have to participate in this?
Well, there we decided to bring as great as we could find, and with the money we had, and it was our own Doris Doe, who teaches here with us now, the university, and the great tenor Dan Beddo. They were both at that time singing at the Metropolitan Opera Company.
Mm-hmm. And how successful was this program? You say you gave this in the large auditorium.
And we had charged a small fee, I remember. I don't remember just what it was. But we had a packed auditorium.
No.
5,000 people for that first concert.
I dare say that's the largest audience that had ever been assembled for a musical event.
Well, it made a great impression on the public, yes, really. Uh-huh.
Well, I remember how magnificent that chorus looked. All the people had on their finest dresses, and they were banked on high stands of 200 people. And by that time, you began using an orchestra, I suppose. That was the next step. How many did we have in the orchestra?
Well, it was first made up principally of just strings, and we had up to 20, 25. A few years later, we had a complete instrumentation, doubling on several instruments, but 35, I believe, was what we used mainly all through the years. Mm-hmm. That covered was sufficient for accompaniment, you know. Mm-hmm.
How many programs did the Society give in a year? What did you try for?
Well, we decided on December for our first program, and this should be generally an oratorio. And we gave all during that period of the many years we existed. Many of the principal oratorios, including the Messiah, Elijah, Verdi, Brahms Requiems, and all the great, great oratorios. And that was in December. And we decided to do a popular concert using lighter music and local soloists in March, which we did. As a rule, we had no outside soloists. We used our own, selected from the group. They had to be members of the organization to have the opportunity of doing solo parts. Then we decided to establish a May Festival using the first evening, which was usually Monday, for the guest artists. We were bringing then usually a quartet of soloists, nationally known, most of them, from New York City, and often one or more Metropolitan Opera artists. And the second evening, did I mention the fact that these artists gave a joint recital the first evening, which
yes,
was usually Monday?
Mm-hmm.
Then we had the final rehearsal with soloists, orchestra, and chorus on Tuesday evening. In the meantime, we were usually rehearsing some special parts with the guest artists. But on Tuesday evening, we had the final rehearsal. Wednesday evening was the concert, and for that we established the idea of doing operas that lend themselves well for concert performances. Without action or costume, which proved very satisfactory, because many of the great symphonies throughout the country at that time were also doing opera in concert form.
Mm-hmm.
So we actually had four concerts. The chorus was in three, and in the guest artist concert, giving us four seasons.
You mentioned the out-of-town artists, and I must say, I must compliment you this time for the excellence of your choice, because if I remember rightly, many of them that came here as young aspiring artists within a year or two were so expensive that we couldn't afford them. In other words, you happened to know them personally, you knew the people who sell the artists on a national scale, and this brought some of the finest artists that have ever been heard in Chattanooga. How many as a total do you figure did come for the Choral Society?
You know,
number.
I estimated it at around 90. Mm. A few of these brought back by demand more than one time.
I remember Doris Doe came several times.
Four times, I believe. She was very popular with our people.
And she was one of the leading stars at the Metropolitan, of course.
Yes. And there were others brought back three and four times, different years for different works. You know what? We tried to select these artists in auditions in New York whose voices suited the work we were singing. And that wasn't always an easy matter. I remember I had three of the four quartet engaged and was in New York listening to artists, and I hadn't found a baritone that suited the part. And I heard this young fellow. He had such a beautiful voice, and he sang well, but he was so tiny, he was little, he was wearing built-up heels, you know. And I just felt that looks also mean a great deal in presenting artists to an audience, and especially in a work of that sort, oratorio or in operatic performance. So I missed that one.
But would you name some of these people who have since become really world famous, I might say?
Well, now, you take Paul Althaus, of course, was, and Doris Doe were both in the Metropolitan. They were already, had made reputations for themselves, Althaus being much older than Miss Doe. He was then a big star, but I knew him personally, and we got him at a good price. Then Pauline Pierce, Arthur Kraft, by the way, is now teaching voice and has been for several years at the Eastman School of Music in Rochester. Edwin Swain, whom I have known for a long while, a very fine concert and operatic baritone. Wilbur Evans, well-known old Agnes Davis. By the way, Agnes is still living and teaches at the Ohio State University. Or is it Indiana? Yes, at Bloomington, that's right. Pauline Pierce, a very beautiful soprano. Ruth Best. Gene Watson is one of the fine altos we brought. Do you remember Gene Watson?
Yeah.
What a hit she made.
Mm-hmm.
And Margaret Speaks, Harold Hall, Willard Young, who is now president of the New York Singing Teachers Association, and George London, I think the greatest bass in the Metropolitan Opera today. He came to us. And I'll give you a little secret there. We paid him just $300. And in a few weeks after he was here, he was engaged with the Metropolitan Opera Company, and we inquired about having him come back here the next year. And he was $2,000 plus a percentage of the gate receipts we had would get for his concert. So that's what the Met did for him in 1 year. And he is still there. But there are many, as I said, there were many, many others. Robert Nicholson was a very popular baritone with us. And Dan Beddo was the world's greatest oratorio singer. And I believe we brought him at age 56, and he sang like a 35-year-old tenor. Great.
Yes, I remember him.
That's just a few of the many we brought, as you well recall.
Yeah. Well, what was the program which brought out the largest audience? Of course, Samson Delilah was practically a sold-out house, but we finally had a program where people were turned away. Now, what was that?
You know, there was a fellow by the name of Evans.
Welshman.
Yeah, he's a Welshman. Great.
They all love the sea.
He suggested an idea that we do Elijah and have a batch. Each member of the chorus would have a batch of 100 tickets. The tickets were numbered 1 to 100. And if you pulled a ticket out of his batch that had 72 on it, the ticket cost you 72 cents to attend the concert performance. Mm-hmm. If it was 3 cents, that's all you paid, 3 cents, and so on. And you know, we sold out the house and turned away 500 or 600 people.
That's
and we gave
scheme.
Also a prize of $300, I believe, $500, to the one that got a certain number.
Door prize.
Door prize.
Mm-hmm.